Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The 42 million Americans who rely on SNAP benefits experienced a short period of uncertainty as those benefits temporarily ended during the government shutdown. During previous shutdowns, SNAP benefits continued unabated. But the Trump administration made a conscious decision to put food assistance on hold. But even as this temporary suspension of funding to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, even that could have a long-lasting impact. And we're not completely certain that the program is actually back. The Trump administration has said it plans to require all recipients to reapply for benefits in an effort to allay fears of fraud in the program. What's more, there are new restrictions. Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill mandates stricter work requirements, and states will eventually have to share in the cost of SNAP benefits, 40% of which go to children. So this hour, we take a closer look at this program, how and why it started, who it serves, and what's at stake with the changes that may or may not come to pass. Plus, we look at the impact the presence of Border Patrol in Charlotte has had on access to food in some communities and how several businesses have responded. We're joined by Dr. Susan Mitchell Gross, an associate practice professor with the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Colleen Hamelman is an associate professor in the Department of Earth, Environmental, and Geographical Sciences, and also director of the Charlotte Action Research Project at UNC Charlotte. And Dr. Tracy Roof is with us. She is an associate professor of political science at the University of Richmond. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Welcome. Susan, Dr. Gross, I'm going to begin with you. About 41.2 million people receive SNAP benefits in the United States. Our population is around 348 million people. I've done the math, which is always dangerous for me, but I believe I'm accurate when I say that just over 12% of the population means that one in eight people are on SNAP benefits in the country. That seems like an enormous amount of people, a big percentage of people. Why? Why is the need so great? Why are so many people so needy?
That's a great question. And we know that the people who qualify for SNAP, their income is less than 130% of the federal poverty line, which means that their household expenses and other expenses are not meeting their needs to meet all their food needs. And that is why they apply for SNAP. And the low-income populations that are part of SNAP, I want you to know that most of them are families with children or households with elderly or households with disabled individuals.
And we're going to talk about
89% of them.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Many of them work, maybe more than one job.
Oh, yeah, 51% of those who can work do work. Most of them who don't work have child care or elderly care responsibilities. So it's those who can work definitely do.
And SNAP participation, as I understand it today, is still above pre-pandemic levels. It went up during the pandemic because people were out of work, and then it came back down. But it's still higher today than it was pre-pandemic. I think the number of people on SNAP in 2019 was around 37 million. Now it's 41.2 million. The pandemic is long over. Why, Susan, are the numbers still so high?
Well, one thing that happened during the pandemic was we saw inflation and the price of food went up. And so your dollar didn't stretch as far for the food you needed. And so even though people went back to work, their need for that safety net to help them make ends meet was really the reason for why so many more people are still on SNAP. And we have an aging population. So as our population ages, the proportion of people on SNAP increases too.
And as I mentioned when I introduced you, your area of expertise at Johns Hopkins is in the School of Public Health. You are a public health expert. What are the implications of that as someone who deals with public health, of so many people being food insecure?
So we know that food insecurity has a huge impact on health. Just my main area of expertise is children and pregnant women, mm-hmm. and I know that those who are food insecure have more pregnancy complications, children have more growth-related issues, academic issues, and for those who have a chronic illness, they're more likely, especially in the elderly, to forego medical care or not buy their medication or delay any kind of preventive care because food insecurity is causing them to spend their time looking for food, actually.
Dr. Tracy Roof is also with us from the University of Richmond. You're not only a professor of political science, you're writing a book about the history of SNAP, and there are a lot of misconceptions about the people who receive these benefits. One of them is that black women make up the largest group of the people receiving SNAP benefits, and that misconception has led some politicians to refer to those on SNAP as welfare queens. Trouble is, it's not true. That statistic is wrong. Paint a picture of who these SNAP benefits are.
So
the
yeah,
recipients, and the recipients.
And, the person that actually coined the welfare queen comment was President Reagan. And there's a lot of similar rhetoric around SNAP recipients today compared with that period back in the 1980s. When we had also seen substantial cuts to what was then called the food stamps program. With the same kind of argument that what we needed to do was to conserve resources to go to the truly needy, with the suggestion that there are a lot of people that are getting benefits that don't actually need them, or, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric around the idea of fraud and abuse right now. There's been things circulating on the internet suggesting that a lot of immigrants are getting benefits, which is not true. People without legal status have never been eligible and are not eligible now to receive benefits. There is a small, less than 5% of beneficiaries are non-citizens, but they have legal status in the United States, and even a lot of their eligibility has been curtailed in the budget bill that passed over the summer. But in terms of, you know, who the typical recipient is, as was mentioned before, it's children are one of the largest categories, elderly folks, disabled folks. There are a lot more working families on SNAP now than there have been in the past, again, because the cost of food is so high right now. A lot of people, even with employment, can't afford to get an adequate diet for their families.
And because race is America's Achilles heel, there's a lot of racial misconceptions about who benefits from this program. And I've seen different numbers, but yesterday I read a research paper from Pew Research that says that 62.7% of SNAP recipients, 62.7, are white, 27% are black, 3.8% are Asian, and 6.2% of those receiving these benefits are steadily employed. Would you agree with those numbers, Tracy?
Yeah, the number for white recipients is a little bit high, but that's because the data that's collected by the Department of Agriculture has a category where people don't want to reveal their race. And so I believe that statistic is excluding those folks. So the numbers that you typically see are somewhere in excess of 30-something percent of the recipients are white. And I think where people get the misconception is that there are higher percentages of Black people who qualify for SNAP. There are slightly higher percentages of Hispanic people who qualify for SNAP as a racial category. But that's because those folks are disproportionately low income. And therefore, you know, they're disproportionately likely to be in poverty and therefore more likely to qualify. But certainly the largest group on SNAP is white people.
The SNAP program provides. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to also say another misconception is oftentimes that this is a program that really benefits like inner city population, but the use of the program is actually higher in rural areas than it is in urban areas.
So the SNAP program provides an average, I understand, of $6 a day for food for its beneficiaries, Susan. We all go to the grocery store. We all know what food costs. $6 a day. People spend that on a cup of coffee at Starbucks. Is that enough? Have people, have families been able to eat enough on these benefits?
So, and I'll say that this is supplemental nutrition assistance program, so it's meant to be supplemental, but honestly, $6 a day is not enough. And if you think about the food plan is supposed to be helping people eat healthy foods, whole foods. The administration doesn't want people to eat ultra-processed foods, but the foods that can help you exist for a whole day are those that are high in fat and sugar and salt. Like a box of macaroni and cheese is a ultra-processed food that people often will buy, or ramen. We hear a lot about people eating ramen. And it's because if you want to make that dollar stretch, you need to go to high energy dense foods that will keep you feeling full for the day. So no, it's not enough.
Dr. Colleen Hamelman is also here. She's with the UNC Charlotte, and she's the director of the Charlotte Action Research Project. A lot of the people on SNAP, Colleen, also live in what we have called food deserts, where access to fresh foods is a challenge. And in these cases, is SNAP helping all that much? I mean, is it helping people eat food that makes them healthy, or is it simply helping them eat food that fills them up?
You know, I agree with Susan on this, that, you know, the food that's affordable and is often the food that can fill you up. The healthier diet options are not as affordable. And certainly in neighborhoods that don't have access to a full service grocery store, it's even harder to find those healthier foods. That said, a lot of gas stations, a lot of corner stores, a lot of dollar stores accept SNAP and are a valuable resource for folks in those neighborhoods that rely on SNAP and cannot easily get to a full service grocery store or Walmart or any of those big chains.
What can people buy and not buy on SNAP? Tracy, are there restrictions to where that money can go?
Yeah, you can't get alcohol or cigarettes or any kind of cleaning or hygiene products with SNAP. And the Trump administration has allowed states to pursue waivers where they can actually restrict the use of SNAP on things like soft drinks or junk food as well. But that's a relatively recent thing that has not been part of the history of the program. But when they've done studies of eating patterns, people on SNAP don't really tend to consume more soft drinks or low-value food than other people of similar income.
You see, Colleen, you see food accessibility as a form of social justice. More than a third of SNAP benefits have jobs, and yet they still need help. And a recent report in the New York Times says that the formula used by the USDA to determine how much people on SNAP spend on groceries is based on a subsistence level diet and on calculations that rely on, quote, unrealistic and out of date ideas about how Americans eat. I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about that. We have to go to the break. But before we go to that break, do you agree with that assessment?
That the measurements are outdated and
yeah,
no longer align with what people actually spend on food. Absolutely, I agree with that.
Okay, we'll come back and talk more about that and more when it comes to SNAP with our three guests, Dr. Colleen Hamelman from UNC Charlotte, Dr. Tracy Roof from the University of Richmond, and Dr. Susan Michelle Gross from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that's been in existence for quite a while, and we'll talk about the history of SNAP. It's from the USDA, of course. Dr. Susan Michelle Gross is an associate practice professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Dr. Colleen Hamelman, associate professor of in the Department of Earth, Environment, and Geographical Sciences at UNC Charlotte, where she is also the director of the Charlotte Action Research Project. And Dr. Tracy Roof, an associate professor of political science at the University of Richmond. Colleen, the New York Times also reports that SNAP recipients typically end up using 80% of their benefits in the first half of the month. Where does that leave them for the second half of the month?
It leaves them struggling to find food for the rest of the month and often turning to pantries and other sources of emergency food. And so we know from pantries like those associated with Nourish Up here in Charlotte that their demand goes up towards the end of the month when those food benefits have run out for residents.
Tracy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, and I think a lot of people don't realize this, the way that the family's benefits are calculated, the presumption is that they will spend 30% of their own income on food. And most families do have to spend some share of their income on food. But in the circumstances we've been in recently, where the cost of other things has gone up so dramatically, particularly housing and utility costs, that means there's a lot of pressure on families to be able to draw on any of their other resources to use for food. And so that's why, one of the reasons why the SNAP benefit ends up being so inadequate.
Everything has gone up. We are living in this inflationary environment, as Dr. Roof just pointed out, Colleen. But is that why we say that these SNAP benefits are based on unrealistic and out-of-date ideas because they don't take inflation into account? I think the last time the benefits rose was in the 1970s. Am I right about that?
I don't know that date. I don't know if maybe Tracy.
I can chime in. So they're adjusted every year for inflation and the cost of food. So there's a basket of goods and they recalculate that. When inflation is going up really quickly, the benefits fall behind over the course of the year. But like say back in the 1970s, another period where we had really high inflation, they used to do the adjustment twice a year. But since the 1980s, they haven't done that. So that's one problem. But I think where the idea of it being outdated, they use something called the Thrifty Food Plan, which is this basket of goods. And for a long period of time, it kind of assumed that you would do things in a very labor-intensive way. So rather than buying a can of beans, you would actually soak the beans overnight and cook them, that you would make all your sauces from scratch. You wouldn't buy jarred pasta sauce, that kind of thing. And it just isn't keeping up with, you know, the fact that a lot of people are working or they have caregiving responsibilities and they aren't able to spend 3 hours cooking dinner. So that's one of the issues. Now, under the Biden administration, they actually did update the Thrifty Food Plan to increase benefits. And that was the first time since the 1970s that had been done. But the budget bill that passed over the summer has restricted the ability of any future administration to be able to do that again. So essentially, only looking at the inflation adjustments.
Go ahead, Colleen. You're referring to the big, beautiful bill, that budget
bill. Yes, I am.
go ahead, Colleen.
And I'll add to that sort of, or build on that, when we think about what people spend their money on every month, there's this idea that it's this clear, right? You're 30% on food, you're this much on housing, this much costs other things. And that calculation doesn't match the reality for a lot of people today. And so folks, you know, our food expenses don't exist in a silo on their own. So if you have to pay more for housing, that means you have less resources for food. If you have to pay more for healthcare, right, or medicine, that means you have less resources for food. And so a lot of people are doing these complex calculations throughout the month of, do I buy my medicine this month, or do I make sure that I've got this food? If I'm going to pay for rent, then maybe I'm going to cut back on food in this way throughout the month. And so all of those expenses are coming together.
Susan, you look like you want to chime in on this. So let me just ask you this question. You can say whatever you want to say, but we're about to face the rise in premium prices unless Congress acts quickly. For those on Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, these premiums, we are told, could double, maybe even triple for some people. Do we know how many SNAP recipients are taking advantage of the Affordable Care Act and will be impacted severely by the rise in premium prices?
So this is... There is some confusion, but I think that most people during the eligibility of the open window for applying, people did enroll, but whether they haven't gotten the notice of how much is going to increase yet. So
right.
I think there's some people who want to enroll, but they're very worried that the monthly amount that they will have to pay is beyond their means and won't be able to sustain that. I did want to say about, we were talking about calculations of SNAP benefits. So one of the things that HR1 over the summer did was, in addition to freezing it, the amount for inflation, it also took out the ability to add some of the utilities and other expenses as part of that calculation. So your housing costs and medical costs were part of the calculation for what your net income, which is what the SNAP benefit is based on. And they've taken out a lot of expenses that families have. And I think it's ironic they took out internet access, but most families need internet access to apply for SNAP. So it's like you can't include that, but you have to use that to apply.
Wow. The big, beautiful bill, which cut those things, is also set, and maybe this is part of it, Tracy, is set to cut $37 billion in spending from the program's budget. What will that mean for those on SNAP?
Well, the estimates through 2034, I think, are around $180-something billion. So it's actually much more substantial than that. Okay. But it's about a 20% cut. So that is going to have a profound impact. And that is really just based on the direct effects of the law. The one of the major things is they're going to apply work requirements that have always been in the law to a larger group of people, older folks and people with children that hadn't been subject to it before. There also has always been an exemption for people from the work requirements in really high unemployment areas. And now you can only get that exemption as a locality if your unemployment rate is above 10%. So a lot of the areas that have had those exemptions will no longer have them. And then the elimination of eligibility for some of the legal immigrants who had status to be able to get SNAP is another group that is going to lose eligibility. But the larger concern kind of over the time horizon is that they will be shifting some of the cost of SNAP benefits to the states. And if the states can't afford to bear those additional costs, which could be hundreds of millions of dollars for some states, the concern is that the states themselves will have to cut back on eligibility. And we don't even know, we don't even really have estimates of what that could look like in terms of the cuts we could see.
Colleen, you're the only person here in North Carolina. Do we have any idea how the state might react to that? And if they have even discussed what might happen if that does occur?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really big challenge in North Carolina, where our budgets are already very tight, and to have that cost be pushed down onto the state. And then North Carolina is a state where the counties pay a lot of those costs. And so we're going to, you know, I think we're going to see some real uneven impacts of that across the state, where you have some counties that have more resources and perhaps fewer people that use SNAP, and other counties that have greater need but lower resources, especially some of the more rural counties across our state, that's going to be an increasing challenge for them going forward. I don't think we have a good sense of what that's really going to look like yet.
Tracy, a lot of people may believe that SNAP benefits or food stamps actually started during the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, but that is not the case. I was actually very surprised to find out when this actually began. When did it begin?
So there was a program during the Great Depression because people were so alarmed by the fact they slaughtered a bunch of pigs and just and burned them. We had these surpluses of food that people couldn't afford to buy, but they were trying to prop up farmers' income, so they didn't want to flood the market with that surplus of food. And so at that point in time, they developed a proposal kind of in reaction to the public outrage that you were destroying food when people were going hungry. They had a program of food stamps, literally stamps. And so you got a certain color, you purchased a certain color of stamps that you could use in the grocery stores for any kind of food. And then you got free a bonus value of stamps that you could use for foods that were considered to be surplus, therefore helping people use up the surplus commodities that would help with the farmer's income and as well as feeding people. But that program didn't actually last very long because it didn't go into place until the 1940s, and then we hit the World War II period, and the issue of surplus commodities just disappeared because we had actually, the US was really one of the few productive economies at that point in time because Europe was so ravaged by the war. So the program went away, but throughout the 1950s, you saw a number of advocates, particularly in Congress, who kept trying to restore a program or create a new program. And it was largely, again, going back to this idea of hunger in the midst of plenty. Our farmers had become incredibly productive during the World War II period. And by the 1950s, we just had huge surpluses in certain commodities like wheat and corn. And the government at one point was actually paying $1 billion a day, or sorry, a year, just to store the food. But yet there were these pockets of really intense poverty, and they started to get a lot of attention in the media. There was a series of Washington Post articles that talked about children rummaging through the garbage right outside the halls of Congress, within blocks of the Department of Agriculture. And in particular, you saw a lot of attention, say, when Kennedy was campaigning for the nomination in 1960 to the plight of unemployed coal miners, where we had really seen a collapse of the coal mining industry and its use for labor because they were mechanizing and they were facing competition from oil. And employment among coal miners fell by like over 50%. And so essentially what happened is a lot of those people exhausted their unemployment benefits and they were going hungry. And Kennedy went through and called a lot of attention to that. And so that is when he came into office, one of the first things he did was to create a pilot food stamps program that had some similarities to what you saw during the Great Depression. And then eventually during the Great Society, it was made into a permanent program.
Has the makeup of the people, the demographics of the people who receive these benefits, have they changed over time?
They've changed to some degree, partially because of policy. So during the 1970s, they actually restricted eligibility to poorer recipients, but at the same time, they made the program more accessible because the original program that was put in place in the 1960s, you had to purchase your food stamps, much like the Great Depression era program, and you would get a bonus value. So they would kind of figure out, what it took to have a very budget-conscious diet to feed a family of a given size. And you had to pay a certain value for that. And then you would get, or you would pay a certain amount of your income, the 30% roughly of your income. And then you would get a bonus value to allow you to consume more food. So, say if it took $200, to have an adequate diet and you had $30, in your income that you could spend for food, you would get $170 in benefit. And you'd have to spend your $30 on the stamps. But that kept a lot of people from participating, particularly in the poorest parts of the country. And so during the 1960s, there was a lot of attention as the tenant farmer system, particularly in the Mississippi Delta, fell apart. There were a number of senators that went down to Mississippi. We had a physicians group that went down and looked at just the severe malnutrition of children and the impacts that it was having. And there was a documentary that came out in 1968 that was played on CBS that just really galvanized public attention to The dire hunger that was comparable to what you would see in developing countries in the wealthiest country in the world. And at that point in time, it built momentum gradually to eliminating that purchase requirement. And most of the expansion of the food stamps program actually happened in the Nixon administration. He actually had a very popular or well-known speech in which he declared, you know, he would end hunger. And at that point, they started expanding access again. But then during the 1980s, the Reagan administration contracted access again. So we've kind of bounced around in terms of the income levels and the folks that qualify, and also in terms of the number of working households that had access.
So, Dr. Gross, let's talk about how it works today. Where and how you apply for them, what determines your eligibility for them, what determines how much money you will get in the program. I'm sure that that changes person to person. It's based on some formula. How do you actually use these benefits? How are they used at the checkout counter? Give me the nuts and bolts.
So the nuts and bolts are, first, to apply, you have to check your eligibility. And like we've said before, your eligibility is based on your household size and your income level, and it has to be, you have to be a U.S. citizen, and you have to have an income of less than 130% of the federal poverty level. And the way it works is that, so most states now, but some states, you have to submit an application. Some states, like Maryland, have an online application. So you submit an application, you report about your expenses and monthly income and people in the house, and you, in Maryland, we're able to upload documents supporting your claims of your income level and your need. And then there's a review of your application and verification, and you will need to do an interview with a SNAP agent, basically going over your application. And if they determine that you're eligible, your benefit will be estimated for your household. And that benefit will be issued onto an electronic benefit card. And so that's just, and you get a monthly benefit. And some states, the monthly benefit is issued at the beginning of the month. In Maryland, it's staggered, so different groups are different weeks.
And
so,
Dr. Gross is referring to Maryland because she's at Johns Hopkins. I'm curious, Colleen, how the program may be similar to or different from that in Maryland here in North Carolina.
So I don't know the specifics of sort of how people go through the program, but I do know that sort of the steps of having to do the interview, be in person, present all of your documents to determine your eligibility, and then bringing that onto a card that you can use, is that piece of it is very similar, but that we do give out our benefits at the beginning of the month.
Okay. And one of you mentioned that this whole thing is based on the idea that people will gather the ingredients for a meal and essentially put it together like you would have in the 1940s when women didn't work. They stayed at home and they had the time to do that, which people don't have time to do. People should be now buy frozen dinners or prepared meals mostly. Susan, yes or no, should that be rethought?
So one thing
short
I
on
want
time.
To say,
yes. I'll tell you what. Okay, let me stop you. I'll come back and get that answer after the break. That's why I needed a yes or no. We had no time. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting author Robin Wall Kimmerer, known for braiding sweetgrass and the service berry, sharing perspectives on Indigenous knowledge and ecology on December 2nd at the Gambrill Center. More at GambrillCenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the SNAP program and changes to it coming as a result of the Big Beautiful Bill and the need growing because of inflation, etc., with Dr. Tracy Roof, an associate professor of political science at the University of Richmond, who's also writing a book about the history of the SNAP program and the food stamp program that came before it. Dr. Colleen Hamelman is also here, associate professor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and director director of their Charlotte Action Research Project, and Dr. Susan Michelle Gross, associate practice professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And I threw you a curve, Dr. Gross, just prior to the break, saying that one of you had mentioned earlier in the program that the SNAP program formula is based on people going out and buying individual ingredients to make a meal. Go out and buying the tomatoes and the tomato paste and the spices to make a sauce for spaghetti, as opposed to buying a jar of spaghetti sauce. Should that be rethought and changed?
I think that current patterns of food purchasing should be considered when it's being calculated. I do want to say that studies show that actually, SNAP recipients, half of their money, about 40 cents on the dollar, goes to those basic ingredients, eggs and fruits and vegetables. And then 40% goes to maybe cereals and some processed foods. Very little actually goes to those sugar-sweetened tasty cakes. So it's like they are buying the individual ingredients. That's what the usual. And their purchases are not different from people who are eligible for SNAP, but not on SNAP.
Okay. Tracy, you wanted to comment.
Yeah, I was just going to add one thing. And they have tried to update. Again, the adjustments that were made during the Biden administration, they did take into consideration some of these things. But it still oftentimes presumes that you're going to go shop at multiple stores and look for the lowest price item, you know, from store to store, like allocating a lot of time to shopping. And one of the things is that there is no difference for cost of living. So the benefit, except for Hawaii and Alaska, which gets slightly higher benefits, the benefits are the same regardless of where you are in the United States. And obviously, the cost of food varies a lot. You were talking about, you know, people that are getting their food in grocery stores because, or sorry, in things like convenience stores or gas stations because they're in a food desert. That food is going to cost a lot more than if you're in a suburban area with a great grocery store. And so that is not factored in to the way that benefits are calculated. It was originally supposed to be a strength of the program because it they set national benefit standards so that low-income states would actually get more generous benefits than the states would probably set. So like the South had really, really low welfare benefits, and the presumption was if they could set the food stamps amounts, they would also be really low, and having a national rate would actually help some of these low-income states. But in the contemporary period, it means that in really high-cost areas, the benefits just don't keep up.
Colleen, this is not just money out of our pockets, our tax dollars out of our pockets to people in need. It's money back into our pockets. There, as we discovered during the recent shutdown, a lot of farmers, a lot of retailers were impacted by the fact that this money stopped and therefore could not be spent by these recipients. Talk about the economic impact of this program.
Absolutely. Right. So across the country, there's evidence that for every dollar spent of SNAP benefits, there is $1.54 generated in economic activity. Because when you give people money to meet their very basic needs, right, they go out and spend it. And so that's money that goes immediately back into our economies. And let's see, I wanted to pull numbers so I had the right information for you on a couple of things. So there are some estimates that here in Mecklenburg County, that when total monthly benefits reach about $23 million, that generates an estimated $35 to $40 million in economic impact. And so when those dollars come out of our economy, it's very impactful across the city.
During the long debate on the Affordable Care Act, it went on for years. Some people, it was clear, believed that health care was a human right, while others did not. How is access to food by most Americans viewed, and are we seeing it through the right lens?
That's a great question. So on an international scale, there is the recognition of a human right to food that's been codified in covenants with the United Nations. The U.S. is a signatory to that, but it has not ratified it, which means that at the most basic level, we don't admit that food is a basic human right. Doing that would impose responsibility on the government to ensure that that basic human right is being met. which would preclude things like shutting off their benefits for a month because of political debates. And so a lot of those sorts of decisions make it easier to say it's the responsibility of individuals to get all of their needs met, and the government doesn't have a role in this. Hmm.
We talked a second ago, Dr. Gross, about the economic impact of this program, the positive economic impact of this program. There's also a medical and health benefit to this program, it seems to me, and you're the expert in this area. Without nutritious food, without a healthy, balanced diet, your health is in jeopardy. If you get sick as a result, that leads to a lack of productivity, for which there obviously is an economic impact for those people who are employed and still on these SNAP benefits. If you're an expert in maternal and child nutrition, talk about the importance of SNAP benefits to those in need who are expectant mothers and to their children after birth, and the implications of them falling ill in a society where healthcare is expensive.
So I am happy to talk all day about this topic. I've already mentioned about the fact that food insecure eligible participants who don't participate in SNAP are more likely to have a birth complication like preterm birth or a low birth weight baby. Children who are eligible and non-SNAP are more likely to have growth poor growth trajectories. There's one thing I want to talk about that isn't being mentioned, but it's a really important part of SNAP participation, is that there's other food assistance programs dependent on SNAP participation, specifically the school meals. So when to become eligible for school meals, you must qualify income eligible. There's a community eligibility provision for the school meal program that they calculate how many children meet this need, and being a member of SNAP or a participant in eating house in SNAP is helping the school district provide universal school meals, or at least identifying those students who are eligible for the school meals. As the restrictions increase, the what we call identified student percentage that calculates these program access, it will decrease. That means less children will be eligible for free meals at school, which is a big part of food assistance for these low-income families, and we know a lot of them have children. And so by decreasing the eligibility for school meals also impacts the whole family income. In addition, the WIC program, which serves mothers, infants, and children, part of the eligibility for WIC or adjunct eligibility is SNAP or Medicaid participation, and it becomes harder for those families to access WIC. So yes, in addition to reducing the actual benefit reduction on the family, the whole community and especially the mothers and children are impacted.
The big, beautiful bill that passed this summer, which was called the big, beautiful bill because that's what Donald Trump called it, is going to eventually cause states to shoulder more of the burden, the cost burden of the SNAP program. I understand they're also reducing the money spent on SNAP by $186 billion through 2034. The people who depend on this program, Colleen, are seniors, the poor, the disabled, children, working people, military families, and others who have demonstrated a legitimate need for food assistance. As these benefits shrink or disappear in some cases, as it becomes more difficult to qualify, do these people have other options to turn to?
So they can certainly look to some of the emergency food providers that we have across Charlotte, so your food pantries and other feeding programs, but those are stopgaps, right? They are, as they're called, emergencies. So when you really don't have enough, that is where you turn. And in many, it means that you get a week's worth of food and you can get it once a month. And so it is not going to fully be able to meet that need. And as it is, you know, the pantries in our region are doing the best they can, but the demand went up during the pandemic and is still up. As we saw you know, when the benefits were on hold in this month, Nourish Up's demand went up by 20%. And so that's a clear indication to us that it's going to be even more taxing on those emergency food services that are just barely getting by with the resources they have now.
Tracy.
Yeah, and I was just going to add, I mean, the representatives of food banks are screaming as loud as they can to anybody who will listen, is that they cannot absorb all of this demand. And they've had their own resources cut back from the Trump administration as well, where food used to be, there were federal programs to give food to the food banks, and those have been cut back as well. And the inflation issue has been a major challenge for years now for the food banks to be able to raise enough resources to purchase enough adequate food.
Tracy, you're the political scientist on the panel.
Yes,
why?
Sad but true.
Donald Trump campaigned as a populist, trying to convince people he would make America great again. By that, he meant helping to rebuild the middle class, which has been decimated for many reasons, some political, others just the way the world works today. And yet he seems to be targeting the poor with a lot of these programs, and not just the SNAP program, but other programs as well. How do you explain that?
Well, back in his first administration, he did not hide that he wanted to cut SNAP. I mean, that was every single budget he proposed had, you know, substantial, you know, up to 30% cuts in SNAP, and they weren't approved by Congress, but that
has
was where the administration
has he ex- has he explained why that's a goal?
I mean, I think The kind of longstanding critique among conservatives of the SNAP program and other programs that benefit the poor in general is that it fosters dependency, that it keeps people out of the workforce. But what SNAP had really become was a substantial work support, meaning it helped people in low-wage jobs get by and you know, sustain some kind of basic standard of living for their family. But now there's a focus, you know, again, on this idea of only giving benefits to the truly needy, which means people, you know, at the very bottom of the income scale. And honestly, I can't really explain what the logic is there. You know, part of it is they want to use the resources
for tax
cuts.
Colleen, how much does Tracy, how much does racism play into this? Or the perception that it is Black women who are taking advantage of this program, when in fact, white people are the major recipients of this program?
I mean, I think they use the racism to make it easier to make the cuts, but I know there are people in his administration that know what the breakdown is of the recipients. That data, they're producing it in the USDA, so they have access to that.
Susan, one of the aspects of the changes of this big, beautiful bill is going to be that immigrants who are lawfully in the country, let's put it that way, these are not the people who crossed the border illegally. These are people who are, though not yet citizens, have qualified traditionally for this benefit because they are refugees. And we are waiting for their disposition. They're to decide what to do with these folks. But they're here legally, but they're not citizens. They will no longer be eligible for these benefits, effective immediately. From a public health standpoint, what's that going to mean?
So what's really going to mean is that this population is going to have more medical concerns. If you're low food, if you're families, you have children who are going to have problems with growth, there's going to be problems with pregnancy outcomes. There's going to be problems with just getting medication, or, I mean, it's all part of your needs. So if you don't have money for electricity, that leads to other health concerns. If you have to choose between food, feeding your children, and rent, it's just like, it's impossible. And it's so hard because this group is legally here, and but they have no right to food. And actually, the Trump administration has proposed to rescind the Biden administration public charge changes to go back to 2017, where less people can get a green card. So even once they get permanent residency and could be eligible to participate in SNAP, now they're making it that much harder for them to ever participate.
Kearns, because of the Big Beautiful Bill and the recent shutdown, Tracy, people have been concerned about some rumors that have been circulating that as they change the SNAP program at the Trump administration, recipients will soon need to reapply to be eligible. Is that true?
Well, Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins actually made that announcement just recently. I believe it was on Fox Business, a live interview, that people would need to reapply. And then it appeared that the USDA kind of walked that back in a press statement that, so there's a normal recertification process at the state level, and the interval varies by its state, but it's typically between 6 months and a year. Families on SNAP have to be recertified for eligibility. It's not as lengthy of a process as the initial application, but it still requires income verification and different things about households' expenses. So it really isn't clear. The journalists have asked for clarification as to what the secretary meant by that. And to my knowledge, there hasn't been any.
So many more questions. And of course, part of the reason for doing all of this at the Trump administration is to weed out fraud. They say that they found 186,000 deceased individuals receiving a check through SNAP, even though people don't get checks, they get their card reloaded. Is that true? About 10 seconds. Is that true? Do we know? Tracy?
They haven't provided the data yet, the evidence to back it up.
Dr. Tracy Roof, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Richmond, Dr. Colleen Hamelman with UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Susan Michelle Gross, Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Thank you all for the air.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.